From wartime missions in Vietnam to flying three U.S. presidents aboard Marine One, an Evansville native shares his 20 years in the Corps in a memoir, From Combat to Command of Marine One. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with retired Lieutenant Colonel Jack Winterheimer, who's got quite a resume. Besides being a chopper pilot in the jungles of Vietnam and ferrying those U.S. presidents, including a trip to the Great Wall of China with President Reagan, Colonel Jack has flown to oil rigs in the Gulf, piloted a hospital helicopter, and taken epic motorcycle trips and sailed the Grand Loop. And let's don't forget climbing Mount Fuji and an underground nuclear blast mission in the Bering Sea. So what's next for Jack Winterheimer? 2 Main Street is just ahead, presented by Jeffrey Berger Kimrin and the Berger Wealth Team at Baird Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Well, we've all seen the news footage of the Marine One helicopter landing and then lifting off from the White House lawn, ferrying the Commander-in-Chief to Camp David, to Joint Base Andrews, or wherever. I watched President George W. Bush board Marine One after attending a press conference at the White House. President Bush saluted the uniformed guard as he was welcomed aboard with his entourage of staffers and military brass. There was a quick wave to a small crowd of supporters and a gaggle of reporters. And then the downwash from the main rotor, 62 feet in diameter, as Marine One slowly ascends and then disappears over the D.C. skyline. A powerful memory of what's routine for the Marine One crew, known as the Nighthawks. Marine One is the call sign of any Marine Corps aircraft carrying the U.S. president, and helicopters have been transporting presidents since 1957, when Dwight D. Eisenhower traveled on a Bell UH-13J Sioux to reach his summer home in Pennsylvania. There have been a number of new models, manufacturers, and upgrades over the years. So, who are the select few assigned to fly the leader of the free world? My guest is one of the elite pilots of Marine One, an Evansville native who has flown three U.S. presidents after flying combat missions over the jungles of Vietnam. Jack W. Winterheimer is a retired U.S. Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel and author of a new memoir, From Combat to Command of Marine One, 20 Years a Marine. So, Colonel Jack, welcome to 2 Main Street. Good to have you here. I understand you just got back from an adventure, riding your motorcycle. Where'd you go?
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. Yes, I ride a Honda Goldwing motorcycle, and I usually take a long trip during the summer. And this summer, I went to Yosemite National Park, and on the way out there, I stopped at the Petrified Forest and Painted Desert. Then I rode to Yosemite, stayed 3 days there, and when I left Yosemite, I went out the east side of Yosemite and south and rode through Death Valley, and then I came back to Evansville. So it was about a 5,000-mile trip.
Did you go with a group?
No, I ride by myself.
Really?
Yeah. Ride alone. It's easier that way. I don't have to worry about, you know, where we're going to stop for the night, where we're going to eat, what time are we going to leave in the morning, what time we are going to end at night. And so it's just easier to ride by myself. So I've ridden many long trips.
Easy rider.
Easy rider.
Okay. Yep. Well, that's amazing. Now, there is a great picture on the cover of the book, From Combat to Command of Marine One, showing you in the, I guess you call it the cockpit, right?
Yes.
Okay. Shaking hands with President Ronald Reagan. He's on the airport tarmac. Tell me about that moment, Jack. When and where?
Well, that was at that was the last time I flew President Reagan, and we were on a trip to Colorado Springs. He went to visit the Air Force Academy out there, and since Colorado Springs is about 6,000 feet in elevation, anytime we would go to a high elevation like that, we would use the VH-1N, which is basically a Huey helicopter that is configured for a VIP. And so we used the VH-1N there in Colorado Springs, and that happened to be the last time I flew him. I was getting ready to leave the squadron, and so the commanding officer of the squadron said, Jack, you go ahead and take that trip. And so that was the last time I flew him, and he came up into the cockpit there and shook my head and shook my hand and, you know, said thanks for all your help and everything. And so that was a nice picture, but that was the last time. Mm-hmm. That was the last time I flew him.
Now, who were the two other presidents?
Well, I flew President Carter for 1 year, and then Reagan for 4 years. And it's kind of misleading. On the back of the book, the publisher said I flew three presidents. Well, I flew Vice President Bush. You know, he was the vice president for Reagan. So I flew him a lot. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they do when you become a command pilot is you fly the vice president a lot so that you get the routine down. Oh, okay. and you prove to everybody that you're capable of handling the president if you get selected to be command pilot. So I flew Bush a lot.
Is there a call sign for the vice president?
Marine 2.
That's just Marine 2.
Marine 2.
All right.
Yep.
Now, there's a dedication in the book to your niece for Monica. Tell me about Monica.
Well, about 4 years ago, Monica is my niece. She's the oldest daughter of my sister. And I swore her in to the Navy as a Navy nurse. And I used to always call her my favorite nurse niece. That was kind of like our little call sign. And she knew I was in the Marine Corps, and she knew that I'd flown the president, but she really didn't know, you know, what else I did in the Marine Corps. So she asked me about 4 years ago if I would write like a history of my career in the Marine Corps. And I told her I would, and I thought it would be like 10, 15 pages. And I just kept writing and writing, and it ended up being about 110 pages. So I put it together in a manuscript and sent it to her, and she really loved it. She always said, you know, I wish there were pictures with it, because I didn't put any pictures with it. So from her urging, and my friend Sharon here urging to get the book published with pictures, that's how it came about. So that's how the 20 Years of Marine came about as a published book.
Now let's go back to when young Jack Winternheimer was deciding what to do with his life. So let's start, you grew up in Evansville, right?
Right, born and raised.
What street on Evansville?
Garvin Street, 1402 North Garvin Street.
So where'd you go to school?
Went to Delaware Elementary School and went to North High School. Went 2 years to Evansville College. I had wanted to go into the Marine Corps when I graduated from high school. Everybody, my high school counselors, my parents, my sister and brother-in-law all said, you need to go to college and make something of yourself. So I bent to their wishes, and I went to Evansville College as a mechanical engineering student. And I did that for 2 years. I was very unhappy. I was carrying a huge load of classes, wasn't doing well. And I just finally decided that the summer between what would have been my sophomore and junior year, I was living with my sister and brother-in-law and my niece, Monica, up in Indianapolis, and working at a naval avionics facility that my brother-in-law had got me the job as an engineering intern. So that summer, I was just extremely unhappy, and I decided, you know, it's time. So I went down and enlisted in the Marine Corps. So I was 19 years old when I enlisted.
Okay. Now, and there was a group of you guys, the Hoosier Platoon?
Hoosier Platoon. I enlisted in August, late August of 67, and I didn't go to boot camp until October 30th because they were gathering a whole bunch of guys from Indiana, and they formed the Hoosier Platoon, which was about 60 men. On October the 30th, we were sworn in at the Soldiers and Sailors Monument in Indianapolis. And then we got on the buses, went to San Diego, started boot camp. That was the beginning of my Marine Corps career. The guys that go to San Diego are referred to as Hollywood Marines because they think that San Diego is not as rough as Paris Island, okay. You know. So boot camp was difficult, not extremely difficult. A lot of physical conditioning and learning how to shoot the rifle. Mm-hmm. That was a big deal because every Marine is considered a rifleman, so they spend a lot of time teaching a person how to shoot the rifle and qualify with the rifle. So,
well, I understand even the cooks.
Well, yeah, everybody, mm-hmm. everybody, regardless of what your MOS, which is your military occupational specialty. Mm-hmm. So whether you're a cook, a tank driver, or an infantry guy, you all have to go through the same qualification with the rifle.
Okay, now, so most of your unit heads to Vietnam, but you head off to OCS, Officer Candidate School?
Right.
How'd that happen?
Well, we were pretty much all slated to go to Vietnam after we graduated from boot camp. Everybody goes to the next training, which is Infantry Training Regiment at Camp Pendleton. And then after that, you either go to Vietnam or you go to whatever specialty you had been selected for. The last stages of boot camp, they came to me and asked me if I wanted to apply for OCS. And I said, sure, why not? And so you had to take the CLEP test, which is a 5-part test, college level entrance program, I think is what it stands for. You had to take the CLEP test. So I took all 5 tests of that. I did well on all 5 tests. So that was the first step. And then I had to be interviewed by, I don't know, 6 or 7 different officers. And eventually I got approved to go to OCS. So while the rest of my platoon, or the majority of them, went to Vietnam, they sent me to Quantico, Virginia. They put me in the Presidential Helicopter Squadron because they didn't have any other place to put me. So I was like a gopher. You know, I washed and waxed the president's helicopter. I swept the floors. I did office work until a class opened up in OCS. And so I went to OCS in June, got commissioned as second lieutenant in August, and then went to basic school, which is 6 months long. And then after basic school, I went to flight school.
Yeah, I understand. I was reading your book. You move on to flight school. That's in Pensacola, I believe.
Right.
And you train to fly fixed-wing aircraft?
Right. The Navy trains all of the pilots for the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard. And the Navy's philosophy is it's cheaper to train a pilot to fly fixed-wing aircraft first because fixed-wing aircraft are a lot easier to maintain than helicopters. So they put everybody through a fixed-wing training program first, and by doing that, they can kind of weed out the people that are not really suited to be pilots. Because flying is, you kind of develop a air sense when you fly, whether you fly fixed wing or helicopter. So by flying fixed wing first, you get that air sense developed. And then after you have graduated from basic flight training, then you go into one of 3 pipelines. You go into the helicopter pipeline, multi-engine pipeline, or jet pipeline. And I wanted to fly helicopters from the very beginning, so I went into the helicopter pipeline mm-hmm. and flew helicopters.
Had you had any experience at all flying?
No, I had not. I had zero experience. And when I got orders to flight school, I went out here to Evansville Airport. At that time, there was a coupon in different magazines that I think it was like $10 or $20. You pay $10 or $20, and they'll take you up in a Cessna 150 and fly you around for a half hour. So I thought, maybe I better do that to, that you know, sense. See whether I'm actually going to enjoy flying. And so I did. And so that was my first experience in an aircraft, was that flight. It's kind of funny, when I was in college, Evansville College, and knew that I wanted to do something else, they sent me to like a career planner, and he gave me a bunch of tests to determine where my aptitudes and desires lay. And so I took that test, and all of the things, you know, like doctor, lawyer, dentist, farmer, truck driver, I scored, you know, average on those. And the one category that I scored in the 90th percentile was pilot. So maybe it was predestined that I was going to be a pilot.
My guest is retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Jack Winternheimer, author of a new memoir about his 20-year career from combat to command of Marine One. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Jack Winternheimer, an Evansville native who has written a memoir of his 20 years as a Marine from combat to command of Marine One. So we've talked about your flight training from fixed-wing aircraft to helicopters. Now it's 1970. There's a hot war, of course, going on in Vietnam. You get your orders to go to California for more training before receiving your orders to go to Vietnam. Tell me about the CH-46, Jack.
Okay, the CH-46 is classified as a medium helicopter in the Marine Corps. And by classifying it as a medium helicopter, it can do pretty much everything that the Marine Corps does. It does resupply, it does light external loads like carrying a 105 howitzer, troop inserts and extracts. So it does a lot of different missions. So that's the aircraft that I transitioned into once I got out of flight school. So I went to California about 3 months, transitioned into that. And then I went to Okinawa, got assigned to Okinawa. And when I got to Okinawa, they said, well, you're just going to stay right here on the island. You're not going to go to Vietnam. And I really wanted to go to Vietnam. So luckily, there was another second lieutenant there that had been just gotten married. His wife was pregnant with a child. And he was not anxious to go to Vietnam, so we swapped orders. And so he stayed in Okinawa, and I went to Vietnam.
So where did you go in Vietnam first?
Well, I was based at a little airfield called Marble Mountain, which was just southeast of the big Air Force base at Da Nang. Mm-hmm. And that's where I stayed the whole time. By 1970 and 71, the war in Vietnam was starting to wind down. So we got rocketed twice that I remember during the night. But we never had any incursions that came into the base.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said flying these missions in Vietnam kept you close to the grunts on the ground. Tell me about that.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to fly helicopters was my initial intent was joining the Marine Corps was to be a grunt, was to be an infantryman on the ground and experience what combat was like. And so when I went through flight school and became a helicopter pilot, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to stay as close to the mm-hmm. ground troops as I could, and that was to fly the 46, because the 46 is the one that puts all the troops into the zones and picks them up when they get wounded and that kind of thing. So
tell me about these landing zones. They can vary, can't they?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Yeah, they vary from anything to a wide open field that's, you know, 300 yards by 300 yards to a mountaintop where the only space that you have is to put your rear wheels. The 46 has a tricycle type landing gear, so it's got two main mounts in the rear of the aircraft and one nose mount in the front of the aircraft. So many of the zones that we landed on in the mountains weren't big enough to put the whole aircraft down. So we'd land, put the main mounts down, and leave the nose mount out here in space and basically just fly the aircraft while the troops were loading or offloading out the back.
So the whole idea, I guess, is to get in and get out fast.
Right, right. Yeah, the standard approach in Vietnam that we used, and I'm not sure whether it's still used today or not, was you'd come across the zone at 2,500 feet. 2,500 feet was considered pretty safe to be out of range of small arms fire. So you come across the zone at 2,500 feet. You make one big 360-degree turn, descending really rapidly so that you don't get shot at a lot, and then come down into the zone, land, discharge your troops or pick them up, take off, and get out of the zone.
So did you take much fire?
Took a lot of fire. One of the things I talked about in the book was every time we did a mission, we would have to come back and fill out an after-action report on, you know, where we went, what we did, you know, which unit did we put into the zone and that type of thing. And we had to indicate whether we took fire or not, or returned fire. And so every time we took fire or returned fire, we got 1 point for that. And then, of course, they kept those records. And when I left Vietnam, let me back up. For 20 points, you were awarded an air medal. So 20 times you got shot at, you got an air medal. And so when I left Vietnam, I had 43 air medals. So if you do the math, that's 860 times that I got shot at. Luckily, I never got hit. Aircraft got hit a lot, but I never got hit.
Tell me about your crew. How many people will be on the crew?
We had a pilot and a co-pilot, and we had a crew chief, and then we had two gunners. We had a 50-caliber machine gun on each side of the aircraft, so we had a crew of five on the aircraft.
And how many people could you pick up?
We could pick up 23 combat-loaded troops. So that was 23 Marines with their packs and their helmets and their rifles and all that. 23 people.
That's quite a load.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Now, you understand you have armor-plated seats on these choppers?
Right. It has a big armor-plated seat that has, probably an inch thick steel underneath the seat, on the sides of the seat, and up along your head to where, theoretically, the only way you could get shot was if the bullet came straight through the cockpit, straight through the windshield. But other than that, if it came from the side or came from underneath, it should protect you.
Well, that gave you some comfort, didn't it?
A little bit, yeah,
okay.
A little bit.
Okay, you had some downtime in Vietnam. You write about going to a Bob Hope show, a USO show, Christmas of 1970. Tell me about that.
Well,
that'd be exciting.
It was kind of neat, because Bob Hope is famous since World War II. He had put on these USO shows, so when he came through Vietnam, it was a big deal. I don't know how many thousands of people attended the show that day, but, you know, he had a whole troop of performers, and Neil Armstrong was one of his guests, so Neil Armstrong was there. And it was really a good show. And to be part of that continuum from World War II to Korea to Vietnam, it was pretty
exciting. You understood the history of that,
right?
The historical moment there.
Right.
Okay, the Vietnam War, you said, is winding down. Eventually you go on to Hawaii. Then you go aboard the USS Juno and the Amchitka Island, is that right?
Amchitka Island.
Amchitka Island.
Right.
That's an interesting story about an underground nuclear test.
Right. The 3 years that I was in Hawaii, one of the missions we got tasked to do was to get on the Juno, which was an LPD type Navy vessel.
What's that?
It's called Landing Platform Deck. That's what LPD stands for.
Okay. We have a landing ship tank here.
Yeah, right.
LSD.
And so the LPD held two aircraft, And so we put the two aircraft on the LPD and left Hawaii and drove up to Amchitka Island, which is one of the last islands in the Aleutian chain, so right next to Russia. And they were conducting an underground nuclear test on the island of Amchitka. They had people on the island.
Wow.
Not a whole lot, but they had a lot of scientists and technicians and all that kind of stuff on the island. And their concern was that when they set off that nuclear test, it might cause a tsunami. And, of course, the tsunami would wash over the island and, you know, drown the people. So what they wanted us there for was if that happened, we would go in and rescue the people and bring them off the island. Luckily, the day of the test, it was horrific weather. I mean, rain, sleet, heavy overcast. The ocean was 20 and 30-foot waves. So luckily, we didn't have to launch that day. But that was the Amchitka nuclear test.
You moved around a lot.
Oh, yeah. You know, in the Marine Corps, you move around a lot. So I was a flight instructor for 3 years in Pensacola, and I instructed in the Advanced Helicopter Training Squadron, which was the last squadron that the young pilots would come to before they got designated as a naval aviator or a marine aviator. And that was one of my most rewarding jobs in the Marine Corps, was being an instructor.
Well, you touched a lot of lives then.
Right.
Definitely.
Right.
So then you end up in Okinawa in South Korea?
Well, after Pensacola, I went to a mid-level school called Amphibious Warfare School back in Quantico, Virginia, and that was for 9 months. And then I went back over to Okinawa for 1 year unaccompanied. I was married at the time, and I went back to Okinawa unaccompanied, and that's when I went to Korea. You know, we spent 3 months. I was based in Okinawa, but we sent a detachment of Marines up to Korea for 3 months to work with the Korean Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I understand you went to Japan. I know you're an adventurer. You've already established that you take these solo motorcycle trips.
Right.
You went to Mount Fuji?
Mount Fuji. One of the things I wanted to do while I was in Okinawa was climb Mount Fuji. The Japanese consider Mount Fuji a sacred mountain. And I think they expect their people at some time during their life to walk up Mount Fuji, and it's not a difficult climb. It's a, you know, it's a 45-degree angle, and there's well marked trails on the mountain, and the idea is to climb it at night, so you're on top, so you can see the sunrise in the morning. And so we did it. We climbed it at night, myself and a crew chief. My co-pilot didn't want to go, so it was myself and the crew chief that went, and we climbed Mount Fuji at night so we could see the sunrise in the morning.
Was it worth it?
Yes, very much so.
That's a great memory. You make the next big move in your career. You go back to the States, Quantico, and then Marine Helicopter Squadron 1. Had you lobbied for that assignment?
Yes, I had three goals when I went in the Marine Corps. I wanted to go to Vietnam. I wanted to fly in combat. I wanted to be a flight instructor. So I'd accomplished those two. And then the last goal, I wanted to go back to HMX-1, which is the Presidential Helicopter Squadron.
Where you swept floors.
Right. And I wanted to go back to that squadron and fly the president. And so I was lucky enough. You have to kind of be in the right place at the right time and know the right people to get into the squadron. So you have to have an excellent career. You have to have a lot of experience as a pilot. At the time that I was wanting to go there, they wanted you to have combat experience. So I had all of those. And then the last ingredient was you needed to know somebody. So the incoming commanding officer of the squadron was a lieutenant colonel by the name of, his nickname was Whitey Maydag, and he was the senior Marine at Pensacola when I was an instructor. So he knew me, he knew my reputation, and when he was putting his team together to go into HMX 1, I told him that I'd really like to get an assignment there. And so he was the last ingredient, and he was the one that got me into the squadron.
Wow. Okay, this is 1979, I believe.
Right.
What was the Marine Corps, what was Marine 1, the aircraft, like back then?
Well, it's the same aircraft today that it was in 1979. It's called a VH, wow. VH-3D, and it's a Navy helicopter. It's a Navy anti-submarine helicopter that's designed to land in the water if it has to. You can see the big pontoons on it, and that makes it capable of landing in the water. So that's the standard Navy helicopter that's been reconfigured to be Marine One. It has all the communication gear that Air Force One has, and it's a very special helicopter, and, you know, it's beautiful inside, mm-hmm. and so that's what we flew.
What's the flight range?
Well, it has about 2 hours worth of fuel mm-hmm. on it, so, you know, a couple hundred miles.
Right. What about armament?
No armament. That's been a standard question that people have asked me over the years. Well, is it an offensive aircraft?
Right.
No. Has no offensive capability, has no armor plating on it. The only thing that we put on it while I was in the squadron was a defensive mechanism where they established or they installed underneath the belly of the aircraft a carrier of flares that would automatically disperse if it detected an incoming heat-seeking missile. So we as a pilot didn't have to execute anything. It was an automatic type thing to where if a heat-seeking missile was coming towards the aircraft, uh-huh. those flares would dispense, and hopefully the heat-seeking missile would go towards the flare, which is really hot, burns really hot, and go towards the flare instead of the engine exhaust. So that was the concept.
So you had no offensive weapons?
No.
Did you have any support aircraft protecting
no.
you?
No.
Wow.
No. None whatsoever.
That's
And another thing, people always think that Marine One has a decoy aircraft with it, and that's really not true either. Anytime Marine One flies, there's always two aircraft, but the second aircraft is to carry press people mm-hmm. or any other people that won't fit in Marine One, and it's there to be a backup to Marine One. So if something happened to Marine One, like a generator failure or some other problem that the aircraft had to land, then the backup could come in, discharge his passengers, pick up the president, and continue on with the mission. But
wow.
But there was no decoy aircraft.
Hmm. What was your first flight with a U.S. president?
My first flight was with President Carter, and I was still a co-pilot at that point. And I was the second aircraft. I was not in Marine One. I was in the second aircraft, but I was on the presidential mission. And so we picked the president up at the White House, or Marine One picked him up at the White House, and we flew up to Camp David. And that particular day was a really marginal weather day. And we were flying VFR, which means visual flight rules. So we were basically following the road up mm-hmm. to Camp David. And as the second aircraft, we were right behind Marine One, really close, because it was foggy and rainy, and we didn't want to lose sight. Didn't want to lose sight of him. So I'm the co-pilot. The aircraft commander is sitting to my right, and we're leaning so far forward in the cockpit trying to keep in sight Marine One that we fog up the windshields. And so I'm sitting there wiping the windshield down on both sides so that we can keep sight of Marine One and get up to Camp David. And everybody got there just fine.
That's good. Now, you write about this famous visit to China by President Reagan. Marine One is flown on a cargo plane, I guess,
right,
to China.
Right.
And were you a pilot then?
Yes. I was a command pilot by that point.
Okay.
And when we went to China, we went to three cities. We went to Beijing, Xi'an, and Shanghai. And the Chinese wanted President Reagan to go to the Great Wall. That was one of the things that they wanted him to see and be a great photo opportunity.
Sure.
And so the advance trip, which I was on, we met with all the Chinese counterparts, huge group of people, and the White House position was, we're going to bring Marine One into China, and President Reagan's going to fly on Marine One out to the Great Wall, and the president of China is going to fly with him. Chinese position said, oh, no, you can't do that. We don't want American helicopters in China. President Reagan and president of China will fly on Chinese aircraft out to the Great Wall. And so it went back and forth like that for two or three days. And eventually the White House advance officer that was in charge of the team basically told the Chinese that if you don't allow Marine One helicopters into China, President Reagan's not coming. And they didn't want to do that. So the compromise was, okay, you can bring Marine One and helicopters into China at both three cities. But when President Reagan goes to the Great Wall, they'll motorcade out to the Great Wall. Marine One, or Nighthawk One, will be based in Beijing. When they're halfway to the wall, he'll take off, fly to the Great Wall, land, wait for the president and the Chinese president to tour the Great Wall. They get back in the motorcade. They drive back to Beijing. When they're halfway back, Marine One takes off and flies over the motorcade and goes back to Beijing. So that was the compromise.
So they didn't like the optics of Marine One landing
exactly
next to the Great
exactly
Wall. Okay, I understand that.
So apparently, I think it's still the case that I'm the only American or only Marine that's ever landed a American helicopter at the Great Wall.
Wow. Okay. And you talk about, that's a great story. You also talk about this state dinner you attend, and they bring out Peking duck, and then there's a very special presentation with duck brains.
Right. I was on the advance trip for the president's visit, as well as being the command pilot. So on the advance trip, one of the purposes of the advance team is to see and do everything the Chinese want President Reagan to do. So we went to a fabulous dinner, Peking duck dinner. And so the first part of the dinner was, you know, we were sitting around a huge table. There were probably 30 people at the table. And so the Chinese brought the duck, the roasted duck, out on a silver platter, paraded around the table so everybody could see it, went back in the kitchen, sliced it all up, and then they came back. And one of the things that they wanted the guest of honor, which was President Reagan, to have or experience was they took the head of the duck, sliced it long ways down, laid both pieces on the silver platter, and that was going to be placed in front of President Reagan with the expectation that he would eat some of the brains of the duck. That was considered a delicacy in China. And the advance team leader politely told him that you can just delete this from the program. President Reagan is not going to partake of that part of the ceremony.
I love this diplomacy.
Yes.
It's incredible. It's incredible. Okay, you and you. I know you fly the president to his ranch near Santa Barbara. That was, I guess, a kind of a routine, wasn't it?
Right. I think I made 12 or 13 trips to Santa Barbara, flying him. He would land. He would usually land at Point Magoo Naval Air Station, and so we would pick him up there and then fly him up to his ranch in Santa Barbara.
Would Nancy go with him?
Oh, yes. Nancy would be with him. I think every trip that I was on, she was with him, and we would fly him to his ranch. The first time I flew him, right after he became president, none of the facilities at his ranch had been built for the helicopter. There was no landing pad. There was no hangar. There was no quarters for the Marine crew, and so we just landed in a big pasture and landed Marine One there, and the crew stayed in RVs that they had parked at the landing zone.
Okay, and also you were on duty when President Reagan was shot.
Yes, I was flying that day. I was at Anacostia, the Executive Alert Facility, and the procedure when you're at the Executive Alert Facility is you take, there's three aircraft there, so all three aircraft at some point during the day would take off and fly for an hour just to exercise the aircraft and make sure everything was working and all that kind of stuff. So I happened to be airborne that day when President Reagan was shot, and so we listened to a lot of radios. We probably have four or five different radios that we're listening to when we're flying. So I heard all the commotion on the Secret Service radio of what was transpiring. And for a couple of seconds there, the Secret Service and the military aide were debating, because they knew I was airborne, and they were debating, should we bring the helicopter in and put President Reagan on the helicopter and fly him to a hospital. And luckily, the head Secret Service agent made the decision that, no, he has to go now. And so they put him in the limo, and they drove him to the hospital. And that probably saved his life, because if they had called us in, they would have had to find a landing zone for us. There would have been some delay in getting us there, getting him on the aircraft. So by putting him in the limo and taking him direct to the hospital, they probably saved his life.
Boy, these split-second decisions, incredible. Yeah. My guest is retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Jack Winterheimer, an Evansville native and author of From Combat to Command of Marine One, 20 Years a Marine. Now, coming up, life after military service, flying to offshore oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico, piloting a medical helicopter, sailing the Great Loop, and volunteering for the Evansville Heart Hospice. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Jack Winterheimer, an Evansville native, a former Marine One pilot, and author of a new memoir about his 20 years as a Marine, From Combat to Command of Marine One. Now, after being named a command pilot, you were squadron training officer, officer in charge of the Executive Alert Facility, and director of the White House Liaison Office. Let's tackle that last one, White House Liaison Office. What's that all about?
White House Liaison Office is the office that is responsible for setting up all the presidential trips that require helicopter transportation. So anytime President Reagan was going to go someplace where a helicopter was going to be used, somebody from my office, either myself or one of the people that work for me, would go on the advance team of that presidential trip and decide, you know, where the helicopter was going to land, where they were going to get fuel, where they were going to be put in a hangar and that type of thing. So
logistics,
right. Exactly, right.
Now, you retired as Lieutenant Colonel in November of 1987. Was that a bittersweet moment for you?
I was ready to retire. Mm-hmm. I had accomplished everything that I'd wanted to accomplish in the Marine Corps, and I knew that if I stayed in longer than 20 years, that I would do more and more of the type things that I didn't like doing, like staff jobs and flying a desk. And
sure.
I was lucky enough that I spent pretty much 17 years of my career in the cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
And the last 3 years I worked at the Pentagon and Marine headquarters, and I really hated that job. And so I was ready to retire.
Right. And you're back in civilian life, and you couldn't just sit around. You got a job flying to oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico.
I flew for 10 years in the oil business off the coast of Texas and Louisiana. And I flew for a company called Air Logistics. And I was contracted out to Phillips Petroleum. And so I flew for them for the whole 10 years. And I was an offshore aircraft, which meant that I would take off on Thursday morning at sunrise and fly out to the Phillips platforms, which were 133 miles offshore. And that's where I would stay for the 2 weeks that I was working. I'd work 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So the only time I would come back to the beach would be on a crew change day, when the crew out there was going to be swapped out for the new crew. So I'd come back, bring them back, take the new crew out. Or if somebody got hurt, then I would bring them to the beach. But the rest of the time, I stayed on the platform offshore.
What about hurricanes?
Hurricanes, anytime there was a hurricane coming into the Gulf, we would have to evacuate the platforms. So that was, hopefully they would do it like 2 days in advance. Sometimes the hurricane would form, or the tropical depression would form, right in the Gulf, and everybody had to scramble to get them off the platforms. So mm-hmm. many, many times I was picking people up off the platforms with 40, 50, 60 knots with wind, and mm-hmm. getting them off the platform before the hurricane came.
The next step, if you're flying for Life Flight Helicopter out of Evansville?
Flew for Life Flight, St. Mary's Life Flight here in Evansville for 15 years. That was a great job, too. Enjoyed flying with the flight nurses and the medics. It was a challenging career, mm-hmm. a challenging flying job. We'd fly in all kinds of weather and land in different cornfields, soybean fields, woods, any place where we had to pick up somebody that got injured, mm-hmm. We'd pick
them
up.
And each flight would be different.
Each flight was different.
All right.
Never knew where you were going to land.
Right. Now, also, you are volunteering at the Heart Hospice Center in Evansville?
Heart to Heart Hospice here in Evansville. That's one of the things I do now as a volunteer. I sit with people that, are in the last stages of their life. And sometimes I'm a caregiver relief, where the wife or the caregiver needs to go grocery shopping or mm-hmm. get her hair done or whatever. So I'll sit with the patient while she's doing that. Or sometimes, they just want to talk. Or maybe watch TV together, that type of thing.
I know you have an adventure lust. Just got back from that long motorcycle trip. You also have sailing adventures, and you sailed the Great Loop. What's the Great Loop?
Great Loop is a boat trip that you can take that is a circumnavigation of the eastern half of North America. So you can start at any place. It's a loop, so you can start at any place. Most people started in Florida. You go up the east coast of Florida into New York Harbor, up the Hudson River, into the canal systems of Canada and the United States, go across Lake Ontario into Lake Huron, along the northern coast of Lake Huron, into Lake Michigan, down Lake Michigan to Chicago, down the river systems into Mobile, Alabama, along the coast of Florida to Apalachicola, and then most people go from Apalachicola to Clearwater, which is straight across the Gulf, 170 miles, and then around the peninsula of Florida back to your starting point.
Well, how long did it take?
Took a year and a week.
Oh, my gosh.
53 weeks.
Were you sailing by yourself?
No, I had a good friend and a fiance at that time, Sarah, was with me, and we did the Great Loop and had a great time. It was a great trip.
Any other adventures on your bucket list, Jack?
Well, like I say, I take a long motorcycle trip every year, so I've done several of those, one of which was to ride to the four corners of the United States, and the challenge was that you had to do it within 21 days. So I rode from Evansville to Blaine, Washington, which is the northwest corner of Washington, down to San Ysidro, California, which is right next to Tijuana, across the country to Key West, and then up the east coast to Madawaska, Maine, and back to Evansville. And I did that in 14 days. So I beat the 21-day record.
My gosh, how much, you were on that bike how many hours a day?
Probably 10 hours a day, 500 miles a day.
Oh, my goodness. Jack Winterheimer, a life well lived and more miles to go before you sleep, I'm sure.
Hopefully.
Thanks for being my guest, and thanks for sharing your 20 years as a Marine, from combat to command of Marine One. A great conversation. Thanks a lot, Jack.
Thank you for having me.
I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. From Combat to Command of Marine One, 20 Years a Marine, by Jack W. Winterheimer, is published by Sea Hill Press.